Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, March 5th, 2020. Another case of corona is confirmed in South Africa.
This is a person who had traveled to Italy, and there were a group of 10, and so they returned a few days ago. But the patient had consulted a general practitioner who was, because of the level of collaboration, was aware of the protocol that we have to take.
And former Sudanese Prime Minister expresses optimism.
The legacy of the outgoing regime is so great in its negative aspects that it is very difficult to deal with.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. At least 25 people were killed and dozens more wounded during intercommunal fighting in Tonj East County of Warab State. The Secretary General of the former Tonj State says the fighting erupted on Monday and continues today. Marielle Wen Deng reports for VOA from Rumbek in Lake State.
Gabriel Awan Mokoi, Secretary General of the now defunct Tonj State, says the fighting began when
some youth from Jalwa County attacked a certain cattle camp called Achuk or Poma Ngabago County. The attack resulted to the deaths of 9 people from Poma Thi County and 16 people wounded. 2 people from the Poma Ngabago County were also wounded. 60 cows and 7 goats were shot dead in the process of fighting. On the other side of the attackers, which was later confirmed, 16 were also killed and 4 people were wounded. And over 119 were also raided. And over 119 head of cattle were raided.
Fighting between the 3 clans began in 2017 when a man from Thi killed a man from Chebet who was living in Jalwa, according to Mokoi. Jalwa residents perceived the killing of their visitor as an insult. As a result, fierce fighting ensued, leaving hundreds of civilians dead, many homes burned down, and livestock either stolen or killed. Mokoi says Tonj authorities apprehended the ringleaders on both sides last year and tried to set up a special court to try the perpetrators.
The court was formed
and it was taken to a place called Konglong. Konglong is between Thi, Jalwa and Akuk. So this special court was set up to try these cases. Even the court had started and in the middle, the conflict erupted again. Now we have evacuated the court members for safety. Before the court was disbanded, says Mokoi, the culprits were arrested and stolen cattle were returned to their rightful owners. Mokoi says he fears members of the Thi and Akuk clans may launch revenge attacks on the Jalwa. Mokoi is appealing to the national government to intervene and stop the violence.
If
the government cannot intervene quickly, it is likely to escalate further. To come in and rescue the situation, bringing some forces that will be deployed along this border, so that the court will also resume its duty. Mokoi says he has spoken to chiefs from the rival clans, asking them to convince their armed civilians to lay down their guns. He says it is difficult for local authorities to intervene because the fighting is taking place in swampy area, which is unreachable by vehicle. The delay in appointing cabinet ministers and state governors is seen by many as having left a power vacuum in the states that would normally enforce the rule of law. For VOA News, I am Marielle Wen Deng in Rumbek, Lake State.
People living with leprosy in Jonglei State Capital Bor say they are being neglected by the government and the community. The leprosy patients live in an isolated area and some of them say leprosy is killing them because they lack food and medical care. Deng Gai Deng has the story for VOA from Bor.
In a green valley near the banks of the River Nile, about 20 kilometers south of Bor town, lies Malek, a village dotted with small grass thatch huts where people who have leprosy are forced to live. The community has always lived in extreme poverty due to social exclusion and disabilities caused by leprosy. Thin 43-year-old leprosy patient Monica Yomkulang appears weak as she sits under a lalop or desert dead tree in Malek. Speaking in her native Dinka, Yom says her relatives abandoned her some 20 years ago because of her leprosy. The mother of four says she broke her arm a few days ago after falling on a tree log as she tried to walk out of her dark hut at night.
Life is very difficult, my son. You see now, I am feeling a lot of pain. Have you seen my arm broken here? Yeah. It was broken a few days ago. I am weak. There is no energy. And that is because there is no food. There used to be some food assistance from the government, but many months ago that stopped. We are just suffering like you have seen. No food, no medicine. There is nothing.
Yom says patients like her are in dire need of food, clothing, health care, and a school for their children. But she says nobody seems to care. She says the only neighbors are baboons from nearby forest and hippopotamus from the River Nile. Yom's family and other leprosy-affected families have survived on food items donated by churches and well wishes. 37-year-old Peter Akony Mador says his father, who had leprosy, died a month ago. Speaking in Dinka, Mador, a local traditional chief, says the community needs many things.
The first problems that need urgent solutions now are, number one, the shelters. The grass thatch shelters you see here were put up in 2013, and since then there has not been proper renovation. They are almost falling on people now. There you can see. Number two, there is not enough food available. There is no life without food. We also need a clinic. It will really be helpful because now even other diseases, not leprosy, can kill. Then we need canoes for fishing. So these four things, shelters and clinic and canoes, are really very important for us.
Mador says lepers lack food and shelter because many of them are not strong enough to produce their own food or build grass thatch huts. Many other leprosy patients have lost their toes or fingers due to the crippling disease. Dr. Ronald Samanda of the Sera Medical Clinic in Bor says leprosy is a chronic progressive bacterial infection caused by a bacterium called Mycobacterium leprae. He says the disease primarily affects the nerves of the extremities, the skin, the lining of the nose, and the upper respiratory tract. It produces skin ulcers, nerves damage, and muscle weakness. Dr. Samanda says, unlike in ancient times when there was no treatment for the disease, leprosy is curable today.
Treatment is there, especially from children from 2 years and above. So the preventive thing is majorly is the identifying of somebody with leprosy with early signs. Early signs are usually the skin changes. People have a rash. We call them hyperpigmentations, hypo. The last message about this topic is that people should prevent self-medication.
Leprosy remains a stigmatized disease in South Sudan, where treatment options are few. Victims are often denied care because the disease is highly contagious. In Jonglei State, people with leprosy are isolated from the rest of society because, according to local traditional beliefs, leprosy is a curse. This village, known as Pan Abil, or Leprosy Victims in Dinka, was established in the late 1960s to host people suffering from the disease. Its name was later changed to Pan Koylegic, meaning Home of the Holy People. Leprosy victims are mainly from Jonglei, Lakes, and Central Equatoria states. More than 200 leprosy patients live with their families in the isolation camp. Duota Akej, Director General in the Jonglei State Ministry of Social Welfare, says the Jonglei State Government has no funds to support leprosy victims.
You used to help them as a government, but now, you know, the financial crisis in the country doesn't allow it. So we, yes, of course, we like the challenges so that we, you know, our government here, they have nothing in hand with the government. But we prepare them to UN.
According to the recent figures from the World Health Organization, 208,619 new cases of leprosy were reported in 2018 from 127 countries. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
From Bor, we move to Yei, where Yei River County and Yei municipality authorities are fighting over tax revenues, with each side claiming the right to collect taxes from traders and business owners operating in Yei town. Last week, Yei municipal council officials arrested two tax collectors, accusing them of collecting taxes illegally from traders in the town. Daniel Friday Martin has more for VOA from Yei.
Speaking in simple Arabic, Edward Logala, chairperson of the Yei Chamber of Commerce, says he wants the Yei chief administrator to suspend tax collections by both institutions until a new governor and commissioners for Central Equatorial State are appointed.
Last week, the municipality and the county fought over tax collection. The county and the municipality and even the Difang Yei River State Revenue Authority is collecting taxes, and we all know that the national government is working to establish a complete government. But some individuals want to take this opportunity to illegally tax people.
Speaking in Arabic, Susan Peter, chief administrative officer for Yei Municipal Council, accused some Yei River County officials of illegally collecting taxes in the market.
There are some people who don't understand how the government works. They decided to go on their own violating laws, and some of them were arrested by our security officers in the market for operating outside the system. And we also agree that there are some people collecting taxes without presenting legal receipts, and what we want is a system in place.
Peter insists that the municipality has a legal right to collect taxes within its area of operation. Khalid Modi, the Yei River County Executive Director, confirms there has been a dispute between local and county jurisdictions over tax collection since President Salva Kiir returned the country to the original 10 states. Khalid claims Yei River County authorities are exercising their local responsibility to raise revenue for service delivery.
That was when the order of the county to be responsible, that one took place. But we have withdrawn the tax collectors back. As a county, we are up our own area, the county area, where we don't even manage to collect taxes because there are no taxes outside there at the moment. We don't have collection of taxes.
Modi says Yei River County will establish a clear tax collection body after state government structures are formed. Speaking in Arabic, Peter Ladu, a local trader in Yei town, accused the county, municipal and state government revenue collection units of robbing traders.
A small
car carrying few market commodities, and there are five government officials coming to tax the same car and others without legal receipt, taxing 10,000 SSP, and we expect a new government to set a real system because the government wants to bury local businessmen without support.
Felix Amule, chief administrator for the now defunct Yei River State, is warning local institutions not to clash over revenue management. Amule says he will speak with leaders of the two institutions to resolve the matter amicably. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, former Sudanese Prime Minister says the transitional government must focus on economic reforms. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you prefer a big or small family? Why or why not?
Well, I prefer having a small family. Reason being, having a small family, it is better because financially you can manage that family and you can raise your children up to a certain level of education that you may want them to achieve.
A big family, in the sense that everyone has somebody to talk to, or there's happiness at home.
I prefer a small family because then it allows you to connect with each other more.
I prefer moderate because with a moderate family, a bond is created in such a way that even if you're so far away, you can easily reach and reconnect at every given time.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The former Sudanese Prime Minister, Sadiq al-Mahdi, is praising the partnership between the military and the civilians in the transitional government of national unity in Sudan. The leader of the Ummah National Party hailed the two sides for working together despite a number of challenges, including economic reforms and achieving transitional justice. Michael Hatit has this report for VOA from Khartoum.
Sudanese Ummah National Party leader Sadiq al-Mahdi says not much has been changed economically during the first 5 months of the transitional government, but it is important that civilian and military leaders are working together. Al-Mahdi says undoing the wrongs of the previous administration under the ousted President Omar al-Bashir is not an easy task.
The legacy of the outgoing regime is so great in its negative aspects that it is very difficult to deal with. The fact that there are several war fronts, the fact that there is a collapse in the economy, the fact that Sudan actually is isolated internationally.
Al-Mahdi encourages the military and civilian leaders to continue working closely together to achieve the revolution's theme of freedom, peace, and justice, and praise government for forming a committee to dismantle Bashir's government and what he calls related illegal institutions.
They set up companies which were favored in terms of customs, in terms of taxes and so on. This again has to be dismantled. Again, what they did, what they had was many NGOs, which were NGOs in the apparently, but in reality they were partisan in their relationship with the ruling party.
Last weekend, the committee fired more than 100 ambassadors and diplomats from the Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, saying they were illegally appointed to their positions. Al-Mahdi says the government should do more on achieving justice for all, but praised the government for agreeing to present Bashir and other officials to the ICC.
During his reign of office, resisted this. However, now there is no point in doubting that he is called by the ICC, indicted by the ICC, and that his regime has committed the atrocities.
The Ummah party leader says the Sudanese people have hoped the transitional government will fulfill their aspirations for freedom, peace, and justice in the country. He says peace negotiations in the neighboring South Sudan have not addressed the root causes of war in Sudan, largely because the parties at the table were in a hurry to achieve lasting peace in Sudan.
The people who went to talk were not really qualified, and therefore the whole matter, as far as we see it, has become something like a buffet service. Anyone comes and says, I have got this and that. We say to them, as matters that are not part of what led to the war, this is something that you compete over when there are free general elections.
Al-Mahdi says Sudanese revolutionaries will continue to be vigilant on their demand for reform, but denies his party has called for an early election. For VOA News, I am Michael Atid in Khartoum.
South Africa's health minister today confirmed the nation's first case of the coronavirus in a 38-year-old man who recently traveled to Italy. The minister said the man is being treated and is in isolation. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Health Minister William Kize says South Africa's first coronavirus patient is a 38-year-old man from the eastern KwaZulu-Natal province who recently traveled to Italy with his wife. He briefed the nation's parliament on the case Thursday afternoon in Cape Town.
I was informed this morning, I've already briefed the president. This is a person who had traveled to Italy, and there were a group of 10, and so they returned a few days ago. But the patient had consulted a general practitioner who was, because of the level of collaboration, was aware of the protocol that we have to take. Patient had presented with fever, headaches, malaise, and sore throat, not much of a cough. And in the process, they took the specimen, and then they got the laboratory informed. And this has been tested positive.
The patient is being treated, and officials are exploring who he may have come into contact with. Additionally, he said, a team of health experts has descended on the area, and the patient's doctor has self-isolated as well. The World Health Organization says more than 93,000 people have been infected worldwide since the beginning of the outbreak in late 2019. Of those cases, more than 3,000 people have died, the vast majority of them in China. South Africa has identified 13 hospitals equipped to treat patients, and it has implemented screening at the continent's busiest airport in Johannesburg. Mkhize also said the appearance of the global epidemic is not a sign of failure, but rather a sign of the success of South Africa's surveillance system. And he assured South Africans the situation is being handled.
This issue of COVID-19 is not going to be a matter of government and health services only. The landing of any of the cases in South Africa are not because of the weakness of our health system. It's because of the social interaction that we have with the world. And therefore, when people come over into South Africa, we just need to know there are certain basic precautions that we need to take into account. Firstly, the issue of personal hygiene, coughing, controlling of droplet infection becomes very important.
Last week, South African officials announced they would repatriate 132 virally negative South Africans from Wuhan City, where the virus began in China. Mkhize did not answer an MP's questions about when exactly that group would return to South Africa, saying it would be between 7 and 10 days. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Still on corona-related news, Australia has confirmed its second death from the coronavirus. The latest victim is a 95-year-old woman who died at a nursing home in Sydney. Australia now has more than 40 confirmed COVID-19 cases. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The woman, Australia's second coronavirus victim, died Tuesday at a facility in Sydney. Another elderly resident at the aged care centre has also tested positive for the virus. A 78-year-old man died in Perth at the weekend. He was a passenger on board the Diamond Princess cruise ship that was on lockdown in the Japanese port of Yokohama before being flown home. The number of COVID-19 infections in Australia has risen sharply in recent days. But Australia's Chief Medical Officer, Professor Brendan Murphy, has told a parliamentary hearing in Canberra that 80% of people infected with the coronavirus show such mild symptoms they barely notice it, and that's particularly the case in children. Australians are being urged to stop the panic buying of household essentials in fear over the spread of the disease. Supermarket shelves have been emptied of toilet paper, tissues and hand sanitizers, despite government pleas for calm. There's been high demand too for rice, frozen meals and pet food. Psychologists call it herd behavior, and it's prompted shops to ration certain products as consumers scramble to get what they want or believe they'll need to outlast the crisis.
Everything was gone.
Well, there's signs inside with limits of how much bread, milk and toilet paper you can buy, which is I've never seen before. The teller actually mentioned that people are maybe stocking up, panic buying.
I bought a lot of things.
Is it panic buying or simply being well prepared for potential shortages? Either way, the authorities in Australia say stockpiling isn't necessary, as many manufacturers of toilet paper, for example, are increasing production. Australia has more than 40 confirmed coronavirus cases. Medical officials have warned that it's no longer possible to stop the disease entering the country, despite a ban on foreign nationals travelling from China and Iran. Those restrictions now apply to travellers arriving in Australia from South Korea. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Ugandans have been turning the tables on the swarms of locusts in the country by cooking the insects to supplement their meals. But the government is warning against the practice due to the toxicity of the insecticides that are being sprayed to kill the flying pests. VOA's Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
As locusts continue ravaging parts of Uganda, some Ugandans have turned the dreaded pests into a delicacy. Christina Balo from Uganda's Kitgum district explains how the snacks are prepared.
Our elders told us that these insects were eaten in the past. We decided to catch them so that we test them. This will also supplement our diet because they were eaten in the past. There is food shortage at the moment because the crops have dried. This will help us for a short while. These insects are first boiled, dried in the sun, and later fried before eating them.
Others have collected the locusts into sacks and basins, awaiting advice on whether they are safe for eating. Beatrice Alanyo is one of those.
We caught these insects, but we are still waiting to understand whether they are safe or not. We have actually caught 2 basinfuls of locusts for eating. At the moment, we are still afraid to eat them because we heard that they had been sprayed with chemicals. We are still waiting to confirm if they are safe.
John Bosco Komakech is the vector control officer in Uganda's Kitgum district. He confirms that residents in his district are indeed feasting on locusts, but wants them to be cautious.
I've seen very many, even they were eating, we found them already eating. Those ones were still free. But after spraying, especially the one which are knocked down where we have sprayed, don't be tempted to pick, because those ones, they were knocked down with the chemicals. The one you caught them before spraying, we have no objections, but eat with care. Eat with care, because the more you eat, then you can easily get problems with constipation.
However, government has warned that eating the locusts at this time when spraying is ongoing is unsafe due to their chemical pesticides. Bright Ramidama is Uganda's state minister for animal husbandry.
People who are selling locusts for eating, they sell them when they are dead. And you can pick dead locusts which are already sprayed. So it's not wise when we are spraying for anybody to eat locusts, because you will not be sure whether they have been sprayed. Now, the consequences of spraying a locust, because the chemical, when it is still active, it will be harmful to human beings. If it can kill locusts, it can really damage human beings.
The government is using aerial sprays to kill the locusts, which entered the country late last month from Kenya. The locusts have since been reported in 24 districts. So far, there are no reports of people getting sick or dying from eating locusts. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO Desert Locust Update, the situation remains extremely alarming in the Horn of Africa, especially Kenya, Ethiopia and Somalia, where widespread breeding is in progress. FAO warns that new swarms are starting to form, representing an unprecedented threat to food security and livelihoods at the beginning of the upcoming cropping season. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Yeah. Thanks, Catherine Nambi, with that report on locusts. The words that twisted my tongues are toxicity and insecticides. I wish we can pronounce these words every day so that we get them right. Now, let's go for Kebas with the song Reconciliation. I guess I have to reconcile my tongue and my mouth so that I can pronounce these words well.
Zamanuja fishari, ligolo white kid on bega so bang to wali. Sarau, deji run bitau, humbagodu sawakulu yom se kebas fulevi. Friendship town biga tala gowi.
We've been listening to Kebas with the song Reconciliation. I'm John Tanz in Washington. Thanks for being here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Let us take time, making we can take it higher. This is the generation to change the nation through peace and
reconciliation. Yes, lessons, all that we need.